Welcome, dear listeners, to this week's afternoon satsang. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Arvind. We're here to continue with the Bhagavata Vahini satsang. We do this on alternate fortnights. We had one satsang last week. Last week, we spoke on one particular theme about the life of Lord Krishna. We spoke about the Rasa Leela and the inner significance of that. We heard from Swami what Swami has to say about that particular beautiful incident. Similarly, we are going to take up one theme this week. It's not exactly according to the order in which Swami has written it, because we thought that we will take it in this form for next few episodes at least, cover a few themes which Swami speaks about. And as we were mentioning even in the earlier episodes, there are some descriptions which Swami has given in a very truncated form in the Bhagavata Vahini. We thought it would be nice to dwell into them. I think the reason why Swami does not go into the details of them is there are many other discourses where Swami has spoken about it, and these are pretty much supposed to be we are supposed to be familiar with some of these stories because they are very popular as part of folklore even in our in the Indian tradition. We have all grown up hearing some of these, grown up reading some of these stories. So we thought we will narrate some of these incidents today, and these are specifically the incidents where Lord Krishna vanquished some of the asuras who were sent to him to deal with him by his uncle Kamsa. But before we do that, as always, we offer our most loving pranams at Swami's lotus feet, and we pray to Swami that he inspires us to not merely talk about these stories, but even to understand and imbibe the inner significance of these stories, as we've heard from Swami. So before we start narrating the stories, as always, let's ask Arvind to join all of us. Sairam, Arvind.
Sairam, Prem, and that was a very nice introduction. You said that these are stories that we often hear as we are growing up. these are stories that many of us would have got acquainted to during our childhood. But dear listeners, as Prem said, we felt that we have a listenership across the globe, and possibly there might be many places where these are not the childhood stories. And even as you start reading the Bhagavata Vahini, if you come to this chapter, the chapter that we are in now, you will see there's one paragraph in which Swami mentions more than a dozen names and says that Lord Krishna annihilated these people or took care of these people and redeemed them and thus saved his devotees and people who were dear to him. As Prem said, it is like Swami is taking it for granted that we are all acquainted with these little stories. And Swami goes into depths and details only to reveal those insights which is otherwise not seen. But frankly, Prem, when I went through those names, almost three-fourths of those names, I myself didn't know the story. I just knew that they are wicked people, they are demons, or they are rakshasas.
Absolutely, and I think even I should say that I didn't know all of them. We've heard all of those names, all the names are familiar. I think stories are also familiar, but maybe we don't, we are not able to relate the name to the story, and we don't know the story completely too.
Exactly. And so that is the reason we thought that we will extrapolate and elongate each name that Swami has mentioned in a paragraph, because while describing the different leelas of Krishna, there is one, there is a section which Swami dedicates to the Rasa Leela, and he gives many explanations, and that is what we went into last week. After that, there is a short paragraph where Swami mentions the different people whom Lord Krishna killed or redeemed. I mean, they mean the same thing when it's done by the Lord. When the Lord kills, it is as good as redemption. It is redemption, because when he protects, it is to redeem the devotee. When he kills, it is to redeem the being. So therefore, killing, protecting, redeeming, all can be used synonymously when it comes to God. So we will be going into some of these people. I'll just give a list so that you know what you can expect from a large part of today's satsang. We'll be going into the annihilation and redemption of Pralamba, Dhenuka, Keshi, Arishta, Kuvalaya, Pida, Mushtika, Kamsa, Narkasura, Dvivida, Paundraka, Kalayavana, Jarasandha, Banasura, Dantavakra, Sambara, and a few more like that. So I'm sure it will be interesting, and it was enlightening for both Prem and me to go into these stories. So we hope you will also enjoy it.
And, you know, whenever we speak about these kind of stories where, you know, here is the Lord, we know that He is here, as we've heard from Swami so many times. Every time the Lord comes in the human form, He comes for a certain task. And one of that is, as we know, that it is for the protection of the good and for the annihilation of the bad. And we know that that is part of the task. We know God does that. And especially if we go into our mythological stories, Krishna avatar, Rama avatar, we know that the number of such demons being redeemed is so many. But it's always interesting that each one comes in a different form. Each one is redeemed in a different form. And as we have mentioned this earlier, maybe it's for this purpose that we all can relate these stories, we can listen to these stories and endlessly read them and revel in the idea of thinking of the Lord. I mean, if there had not been this variety, probably there wouldn't be much to do Shravanam about, much to listen to or relate a Bhagavatam about. The very fact that there is so much variety, it also engages your mind too, you know, because otherwise you don't need anything other than Nama Sankirtan, as Swami says. You just have to sit and keep saying Krishna, 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 or Sai Ram, Sai Ram, Sai Ram, and that should be enough. But the fact is, our mind is cognitively so complex, it needs so much to dwell upon. And I think that is why one of the reasons why mythology is so rich, the stories of the Lord are so rich, so that in so many ways it engages your entire mental faculties, and that way you can be focused on the Lord.
Perfect. It's like, if we look at the miracles that devotees have experienced in their lives, broadly we can possibly categorize them into 10 types or 11 types.
Right.
But if you tell this to a devotee, he will say, no. Mine you can maybe categorize here, but it is not just that. It is very unique. Yes, that is the speciality. Though generally we can classify miracles into 5 types or 10 types or 15 types, each person who has undergone that experience will feel that it is in part like that type, but it is something very unique. It is very unique, and that's why it is so special. And that's why, though we know that there is a cancelled miracle, we go across and we listen to so many stories of people getting cured of cancer. Though we know that there is a dream experience, we still keep listening to different dream experiences, because each one is unique in its own way. And the same applies here also. So when we take up Pralamba, so before that, Prem, very interesting, I'm sure you also would have noticed it, the different demons and cruel people that Swami narrates over here who have been killed, they are not just killed only by Krishna alone. Many of them have been killed by Balarama too. So, you know, I was just thinking that when we look at the Dashavatar, the 10 avatars, it's often said Matsya, Kurma, Varaha, Narasimha, Vamana, Parshurama, Rama. Till here, it's common across the different descriptions of Dashavatar. But after Rama, there is one kind of Dashavatar which says it is Krishna, Buddha and Kalki, the last three. There's another which says it is Balarama, Krishna and Kalki. So, I don't know exactly what, you know, Buddha is also part of the Dashavatar, but Balarama is also part of the Dashavatar. Because, you know, possibly in the next satsang of the Bhagavata Vahini, we'll be going into many of these Amshavatars which Swami describes. And again, there it's a list of 15-20, and it looks like Swami has assumed that we know them. Possibly we'll go into details of each of those Amshavatars as well. So, here it is very clear that Balarama is being considered as one of the avatars in the Dashavatar, and that's why as Swami describes those people who have been annihilated and redeemed by the avatar, he mentions not just those by Krishna, but also by Balarama.
Right, absolutely. In fact, I mean, even when we look at the Rama avatar, Swami would say that it's not a complete avatar, but there, I mean, all the four brothers actually bring the other Amshas, which Rama as an avatar, complete avatar, does not contain. So actually speaking, it's Rama, Lakshmana, Shatrughna and Bharata together bring the 16 aspects which relate to a Purnavatar. But Krishna, though being a Purnavatar, it's interesting that Balarama is also involved in some of the tasks which he undertakes. But maybe that's also...
No, when you say of the 16 aspects, Prem, it's very interesting, because in Ramavatar it is said that Rama had 12 and the brothers had one each, and Parshurama comes and gives one aspect back to Rama. So that's how it becomes 16. So though that is why possibly you don't see Lakshmana and all mentioned in the Dashavatar. Because Rama is a 16. I mean, Rama and associated is 16. Krishna is a 16, and yet Balrama is mentioned in the Dashavatar. So, it's a special time when there is a Purnavatar and also an Amshavatar there. Anyway, that was an interesting aside. We are narrating that because the first name that Swami mentions, Pralamba. Now, Pralamba was a demon. All these demons and Rakshasas have been sent at different points in time by Kamsa or by friends of Kamsa. In order to kill this boy, because this boy is destined to kill Kamsa himself. So Pralamba is a demon who comes in the disguise of a cowherd. He comes as one of the Gopalas. He knows that Gopalas have the access to be closest to Krishna. So that's how he comes. Of course, Krishna recognizes that. But he also plays along. We will see this interesting thing in Krishna many times. That he recognizes it on the face and yet he plays along. It's almost like he's giving a long rope to the demon in case in the last minute you change your mind and transform. I'm ready to bless you and redeem you. Otherwise, I'm going to kill you and redeem you. It's like that. So, Pralamba comes in the guise of a cowherd and he sizes up Krishna and he decides that Krishna is very, very powerful. So, Krishna should be the last I will kill. I will eliminate all his friends, weaken Krishna. He makes the mistake of thinking that possibly Krishna is strong because of his company and everybody else. Krishna involves him in the game, and the game is such that at the end of the game, there's one winning team and a losing team. And the punishment or the reward is such that the losing team members have to carry the winning team members on their shoulder. So one team is the Krishna team and one team is the Balrama team. And interestingly, Pralamba is taken into Krishna's team.
Mm-hmm.
And they play the game and Krishna's team loses. So Krishna's team has to carry all the members of Balrama's team on their shoulders and walk up to some orchard or some place like that. That is the reward for the Balrama's team. This is a punishment for Krishna's team. So beautifully, Krishna carries Sudama on his shoulders. And this is where Krishna does his master stroke. He makes Balrama carry, Pralamba carry Balrama. And Pralamba is carrying Balrama, this coward boy, and he decides that this is nice. Balrama is one of the strong supports for Krishna, so let me kill him first. Mm-hmm. So Pralamba starts running and after some time Balrama notices that Pralamba is going in a direction different from all the other cowherd boys. And soon he realizes that they are isolated. And Balrama knows that Pralamba is up to something strange and funny. At the same time, Pralamba also begins to realize that this Balrama seems to be growing heavier and heavier. So, unable to bear it, he assumes his real form as a ogre, as a Rakshasa. A huge Rakshasa carrying this tiny little boy on his shoulder. Balrama too realizes that this is a Rakshasa, and so with his two legs, he locks it around the neck of Pralamba. And it is said that he squeezes it so hard that Pralamba comes crashing down and brings down several trees along with him. And that is how Krishna ensures that Pralamba is killed at the hands of his elder brother Balrama. And that is one demon's name that Swami mentions.
Right, and I think the way Swami mentions these names and the way we are narrating them too, it's not necessarily chronologically, because one of the other asuras which we made a fleeting mention about, I think earlier, was that of Putana. Mm. She's probably one of the earliest to come, because she comes even when Krishna is an infant who can't even crawl around. That's when she comes, and she comes in the form of a lady who is offering her services as a babysitter. I think that's how she comes.
Did we, when we mentioned Putana last time, did we mention her previous history?
I think we can mention, because we must have mentioned it on other occasions, may not be in the course of this discussion, but I think when we were speaking about Onam celebrations, her name must have come, because that's where her association with the Lord actually springs from. Because the story of Putana is, of course, here is a child who's supposed to be an infant, who is powerless, who needs to be taken care of. That's the stage in which the first attack comes in the form of Putana. Because Putana is a demoness who comes, and her way of killing people, and it's not the first child that she's attempting to kill. Because if we go back to the story of how Kamsa is trying to attack this child, we know that he gets this Akashvani, or the voice from the skies.
The celestial voice.
Celestial voice, which says that, you know, the son of Devaki is going to kill you. And then he tries to imprison Vasudeva and Devaki, that whole sequence happens. Then eventually he thinks that he has got rid of all the children. That's when later, Narada or somebody hints to him that the child who's... I think the Maya Shakti whom he is...
The seventh child.
Informs him that the child which is going to be your nemesis is born in Gokul and he'll be brought up there. So that's when he starts trying to kill all the children of that age group in and around Mathura. So I think one of the people who helps him in that is Putana, who goes around killing many infants in that manner. So
she feeds them poisoned breast milk.
Right, that is her methodology of killing the children. So she comes to Krishna and as a little child and she tries the same thing. And I think according to the Bhagavatam, according to the scriptures, this happens even before Krishna has given his name. The naming ceremony actually happens after that.
Okay.
Because that's when Garga Maharishi comes to name, he says that already Kamsa is aware that there is a child here, you know, who is being, the child of Devaki is somewhere around. So if he do it in a very ostentatious manner, he'll come to know that the royal priest of the Yadu clan has come and done a naming ceremony for a child. So that child must be somebody special. So that's why the naming ceremony of Balarama Krishna are done very secretively. So this happens before the naming ceremony also, and that's when Putana comes.
Yes, and Krishna, in the process of sucking milk from Putana, sucks her life itself. That's how it...
Right, that's how it happens. And there's a very beautiful description of, you know, how Putana allows Krishna to kill her. Because they say that, you know, she starts breastfeeding Krishna and Krishna does not suck the milk but starts sucking the life. And, you know, some of the versions of Bhagavatam say that at this point he actually gets the vision of her past life, where she is the daughter of the great king Bali. And at the time when Bali is doing that great sacrifice, this boy comes in the form of, I mean, Lord Vishnu comes in the form of this very, very adorable looking little boy,
Vamana.
And it seems he is so attractive as a child that Bali's daughter looks at him and says, oh, how I wish I had a child like this. How I wish I could be the mother of a child who is so attractive. And for a moment she has that feeling of motherliness, you know, towards the child. And then after that the incident happens where Vamana, you know, conquers Bali and he sends him to the netherworld. And that is when, you know, Bali's daughter, she looks at this child and she says, you know, I thought that I would like to be a mother to this child. And she says that if I was his mother, I would poison him to death. And, you know, the thoughts with what one entertains in the presence of the Lord is so very, very, you know, powerful. That's what the Bhagavatam says, because here she is in front of the avatar himself. Lord Vishnu himself has come. So both these wishes that she spontaneously has when she sees the Lord are granted to her. And that's when she's born as Putana and she's, you know, she's also mothering the child at the same time. She's also trying to kill the child in the process. And when she gets the flash of this vision, she says, oh God, this is the redemption that I have been born again for. And she does not resist. She does not try to protect herself. She, you know, willfully allows Krishna to suck her life out of her being. That's how, you know, the beautiful description how it goes. And that's why there's no difference between redemption and vanquishing here, because you see that all of these asuras, at some point they realize that, you know, this is probably their best end they could ever wish for, and they surrender at that moment, if we could call that surrender.
Very interesting. The next demon Swami mentions, I mean one of the other demons that Swami mentions is Dhenuka Asura. Dhenuka actually means donkey. So this is an asura in the form of a demon, in the form of a donkey. And this donkey apparently took charge of a region which was rich with multiple fruit-bearing trees. And this donkey with its hordes would not allow anyone to enter that region. And all the Gopalas, all the cowherd boys, they loved to taste those fruits.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they request Krishna and Balarama that we should go there and have those fruits. And once again, you know, interestingly, Krishna sends Balarama ahead here. And Balarama goes and starts shaking the tree and the fruits start falling in dozens to the ground. As they fall in that manner, all the boys are thrilled, no doubt. But then Dhenukasura, who is inside, he hears the sound and he comes charging. he comes charging to Balrama, turns around and lands a kick onto his chest.
Mm-hmm.
And Balrama goes reeling and flying to a distance and falls down. He gets up and then comes, and once again this donkey tries to kick him. He grabs hold of the back legs, hind legs of the donkey, turns, swirls it multiple times. And it is that as he's swirling, Dhenukasura loses his consciousness because so fast he turns him around and then hurls him to one of the trees. He goes and crashes and the tree breaks, multiple trees break, and then Dhenukasura is dead. And all the fruits come tumbling down. Hearing this mighty crash, his entire horde, other donkey asuras, you know, all of them attack together.
Mm-hmm.
And it is said that Krishna, Balrama, they stand there, and as the donkeys come charging, each of them grab hold of one donkey each, swirl them, turn them around and throw, swirl them, turn them around and throw, and that way the entire horde of all these donkeys are vanquished. Not donkeys, actually demons in the form of donkeys, they're all redeemed. All the trees come crashing down and all the fruits are available. Even as I read the story, I was just thinking how significant it is. Krishna says, Karmanye vadikaraste ma phaleshu kadachana. Only the efforts lie in your hand, the fruits lie in the hands of God alone. And here it is almost like there is somebody who is coming in between and trying to claim authority over the fruits, saying that nobody touches the fruits without my permission, I decide who should take the fruits. And the moment it is done, immediately he is removed from the scene, because the only giver of fruits, the only withholder of fruits, the only one who has control on the fruits is Krishna, is the Supreme Lord himself. And I felt this was a metaphorical meaning of this kind of killing of this demon in the form of a donkey, Dhenukasura, wherein it is said that wherein the Lord says, reiterates the truth that Karmanye vadikaraste ma phaleshu kadachana. The fruits are only in the hands of God.
Talking about fruits, this is definitely a diversion from the Bhagavatam, but as we always say, Swami's Bhagavatam is as much Bhagavatam as Srimad Bhagavatam. In talking about fruits and seeds, I was reminded of, more than the incident itself, a beautiful conclusion that the incident got when one of our teachers, Shailesh Srivatsav sir, gave when he narrated this incident. It was very beautiful. So probably I'll first narrate the incident where Swami was going to Kodaikanal or was in Kodaikanal and was going out for a picnic or something like that. And somewhere midway Swami stopped, and usually Swami would, wherever it's very scenic, he would stop and take pictures with the students. So it was one such occasion where Swami stopped there and he was taking some pictures. And Swami went up to one particular bush which was there, and they could see that, you know, you'll have some kind of wild berries and all that and that. And Swami went up to one of those bushes and plucked two berries from there, but they looked like cherries, which were not typically of that plant. You could clearly see that it was materialized, or like how Swami used to do in his earlier days from the Kalpavriksham, plucking fruits which actually were not born by the
tamarind tree. Yes.
Right. So Swami plucked this typically like a cherry, with you'll have these twin cherries, right?
Correct.
Connected in one stalk. So something like that Swami plucked. And Swami came, and Swami was, I think that photo is also there, where Swami is holding that those, with those two red cherry-like fruits. So Swami took those two fruits and gave it to two different boys, the youngest boys in the entourage. And they ate it, and I mean, from the expression you could make out that it was something really, really tasty. But later when they spoke to those boys, you know, one of the boys said that actually when he put it in his mouth, it was actually chocolate.
Okay.
Right, it was not a berry at all. And then the beauty was there was no seed inside, right? They ate the whole thing. So when Shailesh sir was narrating this incident, you know, he narrated this and he said, see, what does Swami speak about fruit? Whenever Swami speaks about the fruit, he says,
fruit of action.
You
know,
fruit of action, you do something. You get the fruit of your action, that is the result. And that fruit will always have a seed, which means that is not the end of the cycle.
Correct.
Even though you get the result of your action, there will be a seed in that result also.
Which is actually like a seed for the future action.
For the future action. And he says it will keep going on.
That is the cycle of birth and death.
That is of the cycle of birth and death. He says here is Swami saying that he is giving a fruit which does not belong to the bush from which it is taken. Which means he is giving us a fruit of action which is much more than what our action deserves. Right? And the fruit which Swami is giving is much sweeter than any fruit that you can think of. It's actually chocolate, which is our, you know, the human version of making something sweeter than it can be, right?
Correct.
That's what this chocolate is all about. So he takes a fruit from where it does not belong, makes it chocolate, which is sweeter than what it's supposed to be, and there is no seed in that. Which means what Swami gives does not make you, you know, go ahead in that cycle of creating another desire and creating another fruit. He says, you know, that is how complete when Swami's grace comes.
Beautiful.
You know, what a beautiful understanding of a simple incident like that. So when you were saying that God knows which fruit belongs to whom, and when His touch comes, the fruit also transforms in such a manner that, you know, it is the end of the cycle. Right, end of the cycle.
And that's what happened to this other demon by the name Keshi. You know, we saw the donkey demon. Keshi is a demon in the form of a horse. And it's interesting how he became a horse. Again, you know, it is so beautiful. All this shows, I feel, our Puranas, our scriptures, when we read, one thing that becomes clear is, life is intricately interconnected to other beings and to other lifetimes as well. So every action has a reaction, and as we just now discussed, it's only the Lord's touch that can ensure that it is, the fruits are seedless and it is the end of the cycle. Here, Keshi is actually a good person, you know, who has been cursed by Lord Indra.
Mm-hmm.
Now what happened is, Lord Indra had to fight a demon called Vritra. And that's another long story. I won't go into all the details, but Vritra was a demon created by the penance of a very powerful sage, and he does
this.
He does a yajna, and from that yajna he creates Vritra. Vritra is a demon who is apparently Brahmin by birth. And Swami describes a Brahmin as one who is in quest of Brahman. And that's why it is said Brahmin Hatya is the worst form of sin. Because you are killing a being who is desirous of realizing his or her reality with the Brahman. So Indra has committed the sin of killing Vritra. Now why I went into even the story of telling Indra killing Vritra is because that story also involves a very, very beautiful being whom Swami has narrated many times in his discourses. This is a sage called Dadichi.
Right.
And it is said Dadichi is so powerful by his penance that only a weapon made from his bones is capable of killing Vritra. And for the sake of the good of the entire universe, Dadichi sits in meditation and gives up his body so that his bones can be used to make a weapon for Indra. And using the weapon made from the bones of Dadichi, Indra actually kills Vritra. And in order to atone for the sin of killing a Brahmin, Indra is doing an Ashwamedha Yajna. And that horse is a magnificent horse. Again, we will not go into details of what an Ashwamedha Yajna is now. But there is a horse involved there. And as the horse is let out, this is a person who gets attracted to the horse so much that he kidnaps and steals away the horse. And when he is caught, Indra curses him saying that you were so enamored by the horse, be a horse yourself. And that is Keshi. Keshi, the demon in the form of a horse. Again, another interesting aside, especially relevant for modern times, the times today where we have multiple imitators of Swami coming up, is that there is this boy whose name is Madhu, a cowherd boy. And this cowherd boy Madhu, his full name is Madhu Mangala. So this Madhu goes and tells Krishna that I like to put on your peacock feather and your dress, I want to look like you. So Krishna is very happy, he says okay. So this Madhu wears on Krishna's dress and he goes about acting and imitating and behaving like he is Krishna. And he's enjoying that.
Okay.
But he doesn't realize that just acting like Krishna is not enough unless you embody the divinity that Krishna is. Because this Keshi confuses this fellow to be Krishna and attacks him. And now Madhu, the moment he comes in the face of the first danger, he runs, he starts running because he is not Krishna. He may act like Krishna, look like Krishna, but he is not Krishna. And this Keshi, the horse demon, comes and attacks Madhu. So Madhu runs and he is seeking protection from Krishna. That is a beautiful thing. Krishna comes and protects Madhu also. He comes, and that is when Krishna takes care of this demon called Keshi. Again, in the same way like how he did with the donkey. Grabs hold of the legs, tears them apart, swirls and throws him. And it is said that when Keshi dies, from the body emerges this being who is grateful to Krishna for having redeemed him. At the same time, Madhu also comes and apologizes and he says, Krishna, being like you is not just about wearing a peacock feather and wearing your dress. Krishna is much more than what just the outside dress and outside appearance looks like. So, in one shot, two problems are solved. Madhu gives back his dresses and this thing to Krishna and he says, no, Krishna, you are only Krishna. And here Keshi is redeemed. And that is another demon. Again, see, all this complicated, complex karma that Keshi embodied and came in this form of a demon, in one shot they were all redeemed, just all released and redeemed, just like Swami converted that seed-filled cherry into a chocolate without a seed, made it very sweet and enjoyable. That's what happened to Keshi the demon.
And it's from this episode that Lord Krishna gets the name Keshava. But when you talk about Keshava, the vanquisher of Keshi, I'm reminded of another beautiful incident which Professor Kasturi would narrate, where when Swami was writing the Gita Vahini, Swami writes there at one point, you know, I think it's somewhere in the middle of the 18 chapters, when by then Arjuna realizes that Krishna is the Supreme Lord. So at one point, Arjuna looks at Krishna and says, O Keshava. And Swami writes that when Arjuna addressed Krishna as Keshava, Krishna smiled because now he was sure that Arjuna realizes who he was.
Okay.
So then Professor Kasturi was translating this part and he said, what is so special about the name Keshava?
Correct.
Right? So he went and read his Sanskrit dictionaries and all that, and everywhere it said Keshava is the one who killed Keshi, the horse-faced demon. So he says, so what is so special in Arjuna calling Krishna as Keshava? So he wanted to get this thing sorted out. So a lot of pandits used to come to Prashantanilayam then, right? So he would go to them and he would ask them. He says, what is this thing? What is the meaning of Keshava? And everybody said Keshava is the one who killed Keshi. There's nothing special about it.
What is special about the word that gives a thrill
right,
to Arjuna?
Thrill to Krishna. Krishna is saying,
Krishna,
right,
yes.
Arjuna called me Keshava and so he understands me. So he was like wondering what is this, and then he was also thinking that I'll go to Bangalore one day, go to Ramakrishna Mission and, you know, discuss with some scholars there.
Why didn't he think of asking Swami?
You know, he was hesitant to ask Swami because that would be like he's doubting Swami's words, right?
Okay.
So he was not sure of going and asking Swami. And so then it struck him that why not I go and read the commentary written by Adi Shankara, right? Maybe that will give him some hint. Because Adi Shankara is not merely, it is not where he looks at it in a devotional angle. He even takes some of these Sanskrit words, goes deeper into their meaning and all of that. So when he comes to this part where this particular narration comes in the Gita Vahini, he goes to that part where Adi Shankara writes, and there he finds this the definition of the word or the name Keshava. He says Keshava is the Lord whose one hair, which is Kesha, has more power than Brahma, Vishnu, Maheshwara put together. So that is one of the interpretations of the name Keshava.
Kesha, hair.
Okay. Kesha, right? So when he says Keshava, actually Arjuna meant that, and Krishna was happy that he understood my real feeling. So when Kasturi read this, and you know, it hit him that nothing which Swami writes is actually insignificant or small or an oversight. And then I think the next day or something, Swami asked him, your doubts are clarified. Did you ask the right people? Did you read enough? So he felt very embarrassed that, you know, Swami, without him mentioning it, Swami was pulling this up. So Swami said, no, it is right. You're the editor. You're doing only your duty. There's nothing wrong. You should satisfy yourself that Swami is writing the right thing.
When you say that, you know, each hair is more powerful than Brahma, Vishnu, Maheshwara, I'm reminded of another little thing from Professor Kasturi's life. I don't know if it happened before this or after that, but this photograph is there in Loving God, where Kasturi has written a poem. And the line of the poem, when he reads out, Swami bursts into laughter and plunges his palm and his hand into his thick bushy hair, you know. And the line that Kasturi reads out there is, each hair can bear a nation's woe. And that is the line from his poem. And I was just reminded of that when you said, because Kasturi says the moment he read that, Swami turned towards him as he was speaking at the podium, and Swami plunged his hand into his own bushy hair and looked and laughed, and somebody has managed to capture a beautiful picture
exactly
of that.
Exactly at that moment. Right.
At precisely that moment, and that is there in that book, Loving God, this photograph. So, before we take a quick break, maybe we'll go into one more demon. Or instead of that, Prem, you know, I just thought one more thought with Keshi himself. The horse is often considered as a representation of the mind.
Right.
And in fact, when we say Ashwamedha Yagna also, when we did an elaborate discussion on that, we arrived at the enlightening truth about how an Ashwamedha Yagna, which is supposed to give you power over the whole universe, is actually it signifies the controlling of one's mind. Because once you're in control of the mind, you become the master of the universe. Once you're a mastermind, you become supreme. So the killing of Keshi also reinforces this truth that the Lord is the one who has the capacity to annihilate the mind. And Swami has said many times, mind is nothing but a bundle of thoughts. One by one, just like you pull out threads from a handkerchief, when you pull out all the threads, the handkerchief vanishes. In the same way, when you pull out all your thoughts, the mind itself vanishes. There's nothing like the mind. So, I think that the killing of the demon Keshi is also significant of how, with the Lord's grace, it is possible to completely eliminate the mind and to go beyond it.
Absolutely, because most of these asuras, if you look at them, they're all people, as Swami would say, those who have fallen from grace. And they, to whom much is given, much is expected, and when that expectation is not lived up to, they fall, and you know, the moment they repent, most of them are cursed to be born as asuras, or cursed to be born as lesser mortals. And when they repent for their mistake, they are given the boon that, you know, when the Lord comes in this form, He will come and redeem you. Or when this particular incident happens, you will find redemption. Mm. I think that is the significance of all of this, that when we come close to Swami, of course, we get redeemed in many ways. But it also puts us in a place where a lot of onus is put on us to be careful in what we do and how we carry ourselves. Maybe with that thought, we'll take a quick break. Dear listeners, don't go away, because more asuras are going to be killed after the break. Do come back.
Adi sidal shoda jagadu dharana. Adi sidal shoda jagadu dharana. Adi sidal shoda jagadu
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were talking about the many episodes in the Bhagavatam where Lord Krishna and Balarama vanquish some of these asuras who have been sent to kill them by their uncle, and some of them who I think not specifically sent for them, but like Kaliya was one of the examples where, you know, the asuras or those who were troubling the people of Gokul around were killed by Krishna and Balarama, or were dealt with by Krishna and Balarama. And just like Putana, we were talking about some of them who came very, very early. I think there's another asura who comes quite early in that sense. I think his name is Trinavartha. I hope you're pronouncing it right. And this asura was, I mean, each one I think had their own USPs. So this one is one who could create a whirlwind at will, or create a typhoon at will. And so he is called by Kamsa and he's told that go and, you know, kill this kid. So his way of killing is whomever he wants to kill, he kind of engulfs that person in the whirlwind, lifts them up high in the sky and throws them down. So that's his way of getting rid of his enemies. So he comes to little Krishna, who is actually, at that moment, he's a infant, and Mother Yashoda is sitting there, and Krishna is on the lap of Mother Yashoda. And I think she is, you know, churning the buttermilk or something like that she's doing. So she realizes that after some time, suddenly Krishna is becoming heavier and heavier, and she's finding it very uncomfortable having Krishna on the lap. So she's like, something is wrong here. So she lifts Krishna, puts him down, and then she gets up and she goes for some other work. It's at that point that this whirlwind comes. The asura comes in the form of this whirlwind, and he picks up Krishna, and all the other people look at the scene of Krishna being lifted up. And in the meanwhile, Krishna is actually becoming heavier and heavier and heavier. So that's when even the asura, who has actually by now lifted Krishna in his grasp, realizes that this little infant, who is barely 1 year old, is so much heavy and he's not able to hold him. So he decides to rise up into the sky as soon as possible so that he can drop Krishna down. But as he is lifting Krishna, Krishna becomes heavier and he eventually strangulates the asura midair. So then as these other villagers are looking, they find this whole whirlwind coming down to a, you know, it crashes down, literally like a huge mountain coming and falling down. And they rush to the spot where they see this huge asura standing, lying down there. And on him, Krishna is sitting. and he's playfully and pretending as though nothing happened and he had nothing to do with the killing of the Asura, and he's sitting there. And the villagers are just more than happy to see that nothing has happened to Krishna. They don't stop for a moment to think that it was actually Krishna who has killed the Asura. And there's something more magical about this little child. They're happy that nothing has happened to him. They pick him up and they come away. And, you know, one of the poets very beautifully describes this scene in the Srimad Bhagavatam. He says, like how those who see a precious gem in a rock, they go in, the moment they see it, they grab it and they take it home. Like that, they bring Krishna back home. Not wondering about who is this Asura, why has he come here, and how did he die. Nothing, none of that actually bothers them. Just the thought that the Lord is fine, and they're happy to pick up the Lord and come away. And that is one other Asura who was killed.
And one more, of course, is Bakasura, not the Bakasura that Bhima kills. Baka means crane. There's one more Asura who comes in the form of a crane, and Krishna catches hold of the upper and lower beak and tears apart that demon. And when that bird is killed, then Bakasura reveals himself and, you know, he dies in that form. I was thinking very interestingly, Prem, you see, it's almost like death. Death is a moment of reckoning. Death is a moment when you come face to face with truth. Death is a time when when you can't hide anything from death. It's almost like that, because you see all these different people like Putana. Putana comes as a beautiful damsel. And Srinavarta comes like the whirlwind. Dhenuka comes like a donkey. And Keshi comes like a horse. And there's one more, you know, Arishta. Arishta, he comes in the form of a bull. And Lord Krishna literally takes the bull by the horns, you know, and kills him. I'll just complete this thought before going into the story of Arishta. But whenever they are killed, whatever form they might be in, their true form stands revealed. I think this is also very metaphorical, very significant, meaningful to say that, you know, you can't hide anything from death. You can't, you know, you can fool some people, you can make people think that you're noble and have your evil intentions within. That's how all these demons are. They appear very beautiful, very worldly, nice and good, and like, you see, none of them come like tiger or lion or, you know, such things. They come as animals which are very useful, hardworking. Like a donkey is a very popular animal. A bull is a very popular animal. You know, all these are a horse. A horse is a very useful animal. So they come as what I meant is domesticated. They are not meant to be aggressive and wild. They come in that disguise, but at the moment of death, their reality, their truth comes to be known. I think that is also a message for all of us, that we should lead our life in a manner that is not hypocritical. Because however hypocritical we might be, how many of our people we think we are fooling, ultimately we'll be fooling ourselves, because the truth will stand revealed when the ultimate moment of reckoning comes.
Absolutely. I think this is not only in the stories of Lord Krishna. I think it happens even in some of the episodes we narrated during the Ramayana too. So I think this is one thing. It is not just about the Asura nature of, about the Asuras themselves. I think it's even a lesson for all of us, that whenever we talk about the path of spirituality, we always say this, Swami would say this, it all starts with the unity of thought, word, and deed. That's a different discussion altogether, but whenever you think of it, the unity of thought or the honesty in thought, that is something which only you are a witness to. Nobody else can be a witness to that. You know, if you're inconsistent in what you say and what you do, that can be seen by people. Or if there's an inconsistency of what you say to one person and to another person, I think when they compare notes, they eventually come to it. But the inconsistency is in your thought. When you try to be dishonest with your thought, you're being dishonest with yourself. You're the only person you're cheating is yourself. And I think that is something which gets revealed when you're in front of Swami. So many times that's the experience people have when they come in front of Swami. So when you come in front of Swami, it's not about you being revealed to the world. It's a moment for us to actually be true to ourselves and to weed out those things. And I mean, that's why it's a moment where you truly can face yourself and, you know, take a vow to correct yourself. I think that's why it's such an important aspect of the spiritual path, to be honest with your own self.
Perfect. And as I promised, yeah, the demon Arishta, again, you know, this is a curse. Apparently, there is this noble person by the name Varatantu, and he's a disciple, and he manages to show disrespect to his guru. And that's why the guru curses him that you are as, you know, like a bull. In at least in South India and in many places in India, a person who is very slothful and who doesn't seem to be active and who seems to be a little dull, they're compared to cattle, you know. You're behaving like cattle, that's what they say, where you have no thinking of your own, you have no discrimination. And so it is said that the guru curses him to be born as a bull, you know. And it is this bull that attacks Krishna. Mm-hmm. And Krishna, as I said, takes the bull by the horns. It's very interesting because another phrase we use for showing arrogance, the way this disciple showed in front of his guru, is to say that don't behave like you've got horns. So I don't know, I'm somehow seeing that all of them coming together in this form of a bull, because it really has horns. It has huge horns and it attacks Krishna. And it's precisely these horns that Krishna breaks. It's almost like him telling that, don't you think that you've got special horns, because I'll break those horns. And once that is broken, the ego is broken. Ego is broken, that body is broken, and Varatantu is redeemed from the curse, and he's again grateful to Lord Krishna. But this is another demon, which is of course in the form of a bull, that Krishna kills.
Right, and I think some, I don't know chronologically when or where this fits in. Around this time when so many of these asuras come, I think especially when Krishna was a very, very small child, they do realize that some of it must be being plotted by the evil Kamsa. So I think around that time is when the whole village actually shifts to Vrindavan from Gokul. I think it is a little farther away from the kingdom of Mathura or something like that, or it's cut off by the river Yamuna or something. So I think that is around the time when they shift, because of these many incidents which happen, where so many kind of threats come in the form of all these things. Another very famous incident which is narrated is that of an asura who comes in the form of a cart, a push cart.
Shakatasura.
Shakatasura is another person who comes in that time. And it is very beautifully described, where again Lord Krishna is a very small child in the form of an infant. And there is a ceremony which is going on in the house. There's a festival or something. So Mother Yashoda is very busy. And Lord Krishna starts crying to be fed. And they put him in one of the corners in the courtyard and say, no, now everybody's busy, now don't come and make a fuss. So they put him under this cart so that, you know, there's a shade over him, because it's in the courtyard. And that cart happens to be this Shakatasura, who's actually a demon who's come in the form of the cart. I mean, there are different versions. There's one version which says that he's actually only the wheel of the cart. He's not the entire cart. He takes the form of a wheel and he, attaches himself to the cart which is there in that courtyard. So actually Krishna is pretending as though he's very upset and he's not being given the attention because everybody is busy with their works. So he starts crying and he wants to create some form of havoc. He wants to do something. So, I mean, there are many, many descriptions. I think there's that one beautiful paragraph which we read in one of the chapters, where the different kind of mischief which Krishna does. So there actually all of this is described. So these were ways by which he would gain the attention of the people in the house. He would do something by which, you know, people would come and scold him. So that way he'll catch their attention. So they would say that he would go into people's house. If he finds that there's no milk, he will find the babies who are sleeping around and he'll go pinch them and make them cry. And you know, that was a way by which he would leave a trail behind that Krishna has come and he is unhappy with nothing offered to him. So he has done something like this and he has gone. Or he would go into the cow shed and release the calves and come away. I mean, you're not supposed to leave them untied throughout the day. So he would go and leave the calves untied and come away, or something like that. So at this point he wants to, register his unhappiness that he's not the center of activities in the house. And that's when he starts crying and making a tantrum, and he kicks that cart which is above him just to give him shade. And to the shock of all of them, this cart actually upturns and it rolls a few times, and I think some say it flies up in the air and falls. And in the same way, this asura is also actually given redemption in this form. Because when they run up to there, unlike the other asuras where they see that there is a body of an asura lying there, there's actually no trace of an asura itself. They think that probably it's just a, you know, the cart must have rolled over or somebody must have hit the cart or something like that. Because here they say this is one case where even a trace of the asura is not seen because he is given redemption completely removed from the mortal plane. That is how he is given redemption. And everybody rushes, and this time again, they do not look around. They look at Krishna, they look at his feet. Have you hurt? You kicked it, you know, have you sustained any injuries in your leg? So again, this was another incident which happens very, very early in the life of Lord Krishna.
You made a very interesting point there when you said that Krishna does mischief and does things to catch attention, you know. Even at the cost of that mischief, apparently hurting someone.
Absolutely, or right.
Irritating someone. Because, you know, just 2 days back, I had been to this, been to a state conference, Satya Sai state conference in Orissa.
Mm-hmm.
On the way back, in the flight from Vishakhapatnam to Bangalore, a person happened to come and sit next to me, and he was a non-stop talker, you know. Actually, I consider myself as a yap case or a person who keeps yapping. And I myself was surprised with the amount this other person was talking without me having got the chance to even open my mouth. You know, he was talking about his work, about his this, about everything. And I was just wondering why on earth is he telling me all this. But I just was being courteous and listening. And suddenly he also felt that maybe I'm not listening enough and maybe I'm not giving a chance to me. He said, so what about you? Where are you from? What is this? And he asked me 10 questions. I chose to answer just one or two, and I said, I'm from Puttaparthi and Satya Sai. And Satya Sai, you know, this person, and he started, and the half an hour conversation that followed was all about how he has got married into a family where the girl believes Swami, and this person strongly believes that there are so many problems that he's facing in his life, and because of his wife's, in his words,
mm-hmm.
blind belief in Swami, he says that I had no feelings towards this Swami, but you know, I'm now irritated by the Satya Sai because he, everything, anything, and then my wife says, no, Swami will take care, Swami will take, what is this? And she says that for me, Swami is more than my husband, how can a wife speak less? And he said, you know, so please don't mind me, you know, I have got nothing against you, you are a very nice, he's telling me this. From whatever you have done, you are a very nice person. You are so nice. I wonder why all Sai devotees can't be like this. But I have got so many things against Swami. I don't know why he is doing this. Why he's coming and simply planting so much mischief and unnecessary attention in my life. When you were narrating that, you know, I somehow got reminded of this because it's fresh. Just 2 days old, this episode is. What I told him is, see, there are many people who have faced very strange kind of difficulties in their life. And unasked, Swami comes in and disrupts their life in a positive way, you know, and attracts them. And I said, you feel that your life is actually all positive and fine, and simply this person is coming and disrupting in a negative way. Today when you were speaking this, it suddenly struck me, and that what I told him is, whether it's a positive disruption or a negative disruption, it's a disruption. It is possibly the Lord's way of telling you that, come, you know, notice me. This is what I told him. And he said, I don't agree. For me, my God is Balaji. I said, yeah, you be loyal to Balaji only. But I somehow feel this is what I told him. And after that, again, he went on for next 40 minutes. But Prem, this much I must say that when we got off the flight, I finally came to pick up my baggage. And I said, okay, this is where I think we say a goodbye. It was nice meeting you. He came and embraced me so tight. And he said, I feel so light, I feel so happy, I feel so nice, I told all this, I don't know why I shared all this with you, but I feel nice, thank you, I'll keep in touch, and he left. I don't know whether he'll come to Puttaparthi or not, but I just feel that, yes, whenever Lord comes in our life, it's a disruption. It's a disruption because the Lord is telling us, notice me, because this is the goal of your life. Sometimes those disruptions are positive, where a medical ailment gets cured, or some relationship gets sealed, or something nice happens, you win. But sometimes those disruptions are negative also, because we have heard from many devotees where there's a loss of a loved one, it's a disease or it's a problem, different things, but it's a disruption. And I feel that when we read Swami writing in the Bhagavata Vahini, that Krishna would not only do these miracles, but he would also let the calves loose, go and create havocs in homes so that he is noticed. I feel both of them are leelas of the Lord, where the Lord wants you to notice him and realize that he is the goal of your life. Because all these so-called in-quote damages that he does, he can set right in a moment. Everything will fall in place and become beautiful. But that disruption is used just so that you learn to focus on the right things in life. And this is just what something that struck me, and I thought I should share it here.
Very beautiful. Because in the last week when we were narrating that episode of Krishna taking away the clothes of the gopis, and where the gopis look at Krishna and say, Krishna, is this dharma what you're doing? And Krishna looks at them and says, is this your dharma? You have done so much penance. You are still sticking onto your body consciousness. You ask yourself, is what you are doing dharma? I mean, when you look at that, when Krishna is there in Gokul Vrindavan, when he is in the family, I think he must be saying that, do you have any idea how much you have yearned for this opportunity and you are not making me the center of all your activities? You know, you have done so much and I have come into your family and, you know, I am still in a corner. You are leaving me aside and you are tending to other guests, you are tending to your other works. I think that's a message to all of us. You know, what have we done? We have no idea to have Swami walk into our lives, to have Swami to become a member of our family. After that, if we confine him to a puja room and go about our regular work and money making and gathering of attachments and relationships, I think all, as you're saying, all that which happens in the form of disruptions is so that we wake up and say that, you know, here is the Lord. He needs to be given all the attention. Everything that we do and everything that we go about trying to achieve in life should be centered around him. I think that's a call to attention from Swami in that manner.
Absolutely. Because Prem, I'm sure having interviewed people and having listened to so many stories, how many people we have come across who say that, you know, everything was in shambles. Financially, they were gone. And the moment they focus onto Swami, everything is again set right. It's like Swami says, I'm creating this kind of a financial meltdown or this problem just so that you learn to focus on me. You don't worry, those are all incidental. In the same way, not only thus, medically, people are going down into ruins, into dumps. And that is the only thing that makes them turn towards God. Otherwise, everybody is so lost in their own world, they don't turn to God. The moment they turn to God, Swami is almost, it's almost like Swami saying, good, now this is your focus. As long as you are focusing on God, I shall ensure that nothing disturbs you that turns your focus away from God. And there are miraculous healings taking place. There are miraculous cures taking place. And in everything, relationships are going bad and you are on the verge of committing suicide. You are gone. You are depressed. You turn to God. And then you realize that everything else is nonsense. Let me focus on God. The moment you decide that, everything else becomes right. This is a very common feature that we have observed as we listen to many devotees' stories. And that's why I feel these kind of negative disruptions that we call, we should be grateful for them, for they help us focus on the Lord. Dear listeners, at this point, we will disrupt our program and take a quick little break. On the other side of the break, we'll continue. As I said, we have got many more. Kuvalaya, Pida, Mushtika, Kamsa, Narkasura, Dvivida, all of them coming after this little break.
Chinni Krishna Murali Dhar.
Krishna Murali.
Welcome back, dear listeners. As we continue with the different demons and people redeemed and killed by Krishna, again, we're not sticking to strict chronology, but I just thought, having finished the donkey, the horse and the bull, I thought we should also finish an ape and an elephant that are left, okay? So this ape, his name is Dvivida, and is supposed to be a friend of Narkasura. And, well, he's supposed to have been a minister of Sugriva also, you know, mm-hmm. So he's lasted quite some time across one yuga. And Dvivida is upset over Krishna and Balarama, generally because Krishna has been responsible for the death of Narkasura. So this happens much, much later. I'm just finding the common thread of animals and therefore have brought in Dvivida. So Dvivida comes and it is said that he was so powerful that he would create waves in the river by his arms, and those waves would go as cyclones and floods and tsunamis. Maybe the word tsunami was not yet known those days, but that is how he would create havoc and destruction in all the regions that were ruled by the Krishna and Balarama. That is how he would do. So this Dvivida, once he sees Balarama with his consort in a garden, and he decides to, you know, go and take his revenge. So he goes, and as he tries to scare the consort is scared, but then Balarama picks up some stones and starts throwing it towards Dvivida, shooing him away like how you would shoo a monkey.
Mm-hmm.
Dvivida gets wild and he then jumps down, takes on his huge form, plucks a tree and comes charging towards Balarama. That is when Balarama realizes that this is not a simple monkey playing mischief. This is a bigger monkey, a monkey mind that is playing devastating mischief. And it is said that Balarama picks up his plow, and there is a battle that ensues, at the end of which he smashes the skull of Dvivida. And that is how Dvivida is annihilated and the people are protected from this another demon. So that was the demon in the form of an ape. The other is not actually a demon, but Kuvalaya Pida is supposed to be a tusker. Tusker in rut. We have all heard about how when these male elephants get into rut, when mm-hmm. they get into heat, they go crazy, and it's called musht also, I think. There's a liquid that oozes from their temple region, and it is said that they are extremely aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
So Kuvalaya Pida was a huge tusker, and he was in rut, he was in musht. And this is the time when Kamsa has invited Krishna and Balarama over to the capital so that they can participate in the different games, out of which one of them is a wrestling match in which he hopes that his best wrestlers, Chanura and Mushtika, will crush the boys to death. So as they are being led to the wrestling pits, they have to pass through a narrow passage. In that passage, Kuvalaya Pida is parked with the mahout. And as Krishna comes, this aggressive elephant charges towards Krishna. There are two variants of the story. One says that Krishna catches hold of the trunk of the elephant, climbs on to the head of the elephant, crushes the head with one strong blow and kills the elephant. The other says that he goes and hits it repeatedly and he tames the elephant. The elephant's aggression is gone and it falls at Krishna's feet. So either way, he redeems the elephant and destroys the aggression of the elephant. So that is another name that Swami mentions in the Bhagavata Vahini, which is that of Kuvalaya Pida, the rut-driven tusker.
Right. And, I mean, as you were saying, that these are all over a period of time. There are many, many asuras who are killed by Krishna later too. But most of them, especially this period, which we are talking about in the Bhagavatam too, in Gokul, when Krishna was in Vrindavan, later it happens that Akrura is sent to bring Krishna and Balarama to Mathura, where, you know, Kamsa is finally trying to have this opportunity to kill them. And I think Akrura, we had spoken about him in length when we did the Navavida Bhakti. He is supposed, Swami mentions him as the example for the Bhakti, the Vandana part of Bhakti, if I'm not wrong.
Correct, yes.
Right, and then they eventually come to Mathura. Probably we've spoken so much about the Asuras. Maybe we'll speak about a devotee also when, you know, at this period when Krishna and Balarama finally come to Mathura. There's this very, very sweet episode which is narrated. You know, all said and done, Krishna and Mathura are boys who come from the countryside, right? It's supposed to be a very small gathering, you know, rustic gathering of cowherds and small-time farmers who are living together in this village. So for the first time, they're coming to the city. Mathura is supposed to be like the metropolitan of that time, right? It's got these huge palaces and very sprawling gardens. So the two young boys are going around and they're so enamored by the beauty of Mathura. So they go into the one of the royal gardens, and there are these very, very fragrant flowers. They're drawn by all of these gardens. They go there and they find that there is a lady who's plucking flowers. And she's actually a scent maker, or whatever, I don't know what
perfume
maker, perfumes. I don't know what that name is called.
Okay.
So she is the one who actually plucks these flowers every day, and she makes perfumes that eventually goes to the king. So she happens to be a hunchbacked woman. So she's plucking these flowers, and Krishna goes up to her and addresses her, and Krishna says, "Oh Sundari, will you give us also some scent?" Right? And she's a hunchback, and she's always been ridiculed about her appearance. Her name is Kubja. So she turns back and she sees these, you know, very, very attractive looking two young boys. And, you know, at this point, actually, in the Bhagavatam says that she has never seen somebody so beautiful. And it's not about beauty. It's about, good looks, the male handsomeness, as Swami would say. You can't say they're beautiful. You can't say they're handsome. They're like perfect. And more than anything, it's the perfectness of the limbs which strikes her, because she herself is somebody who lacks that.
Perfect. Correct.
Right? So she looks at them, and she's enamored by the beauty. And the other thing is she's so angry. She's saying, and she looks at Krishna and says, just because you have good looks,
don't mock me.
You know, don't mock at me. Don't ridicule me like this by calling me Sundari. So, and Krishna is, you know, keeps a very innocent face and says, why are you saying that? I mean, I'm addressing you as Sundari. I'm genuinely saying that. And then she says, you know, can't you make out I'm a hunchback? People look at me and call me a kuni. A kuni means a hunchback. How do you call me a Sundari? And then Krishna says, see, people see call you what they see. They see your body, they see your distorted body, and they call you that. I see the beauty within, so I look at you and I address you as Sundari. And, you know, the anger just vanishes, because she knows that there's something very, very genuine about what Krishna is saying, that he is not mocking, he is not making fun of her, he is genuinely saying this. And then again Krishna says, will you give us the scent, because we have never experienced such fragrance and never had such perfumes. So then she says, you know, if I give this to you, I'll be executed, because all this is meant for the king. All this garden and all that comes here is meant for the king. So then Krishna says, but, you know, I'm very fascinated by the fragrance. Will you give me a little? So at that point, you know, Kubja says that even if this means giving my life away, I would rather give it to you and die rather than denying you anything. So she gives the whole thing to Krishna and she says, you can have it. So the story goes that at that point, actually, Krishna holds her chin, you know, like how you tenderly hold a chin of a child, and stamps on her feet. You know, that's how the scriptures describe. And he straightens up this lady who's an hunchback and transforms her into a beautiful woman. So then Krishna says, you know, I saw the beauty in you. So now let me make you express that beauty outside and may transform you. So that's one of the very beautiful episodes. And, you know, she is actually a devotee who actually travels with Krishna to Dwaraka. She grows old serving Krishna till the very end. Who's one of the devotees, first few devotees in Mathura when Krishna goes there.
You know, when you speak of Kubja as one of the first few devotees, it's very difficult not to make a comparison with the first few devotees who came to Swami also. Because when you look at the kind of miracles that was done, it also looks like even in Satya Sai Avatar, it was the first few devotees, the early devotees, Swami's childhood friends, they are the ones who really saw some of the most mind-blowing, dazzling, you know, baffling kind of miracles. Even in Krishna's life, possibly Kubja straightening her back in one instant is one of the last few miracles that that Krishna performed. Because even at this point in time, after this, when we see the killing of the people as well, whether it's Mushtika, Chanura, Kamsa, or Jarasandha, Banasura, all of them have been killed by different military stratagems or by some interesting idea, or by, you know, it doesn't look like directly divine. Of course, because of our faith in Krishna, we know that nobody other than God can come up with such a kind of a foolproof plan or a stratagem. But if one were to not have faith in Krishna, it will look like an extremely clever ploy or an interesting stratagem or something that doesn't need divinity to execute it. So, it's almost like after his childhood, Krishna gave up that kind of miracles, gave up that kind of killing of demons and all the wicked people, because he killed them even when we possibly in the next satsang we'll be discussing Jarasandha, Narakasura, all of them, it is different stratagems, and it's not Krishna directly like in the case of Dhenukasura, catches hold of a tail of a donkey and chucks the donkey kilometers away onto a tree. I mean, that is absolutely superhuman and mind-boggling. Anybody who sees it will be convinced of Krishna's divinity. It's interesting that Krishna stopped all such things, because we find a similar thing in Swami's case also. After the early childhood, the Leelas transformed into Mahimas, and those Mahimas got, you know, more and more like, if you don't have faith in Swami, it will look like as if, of course, yeah, he established the hospital, but yeah, fine, I think if you have the right contacts, if you have the right attitude, I think you can also do it. That's the kind of feeling that comes. And I feel that also Swami did with a purpose, because he wanted us to get inspired to feel that we also can reach his level. Otherwise, it will always be that God is God, like the East is the East and the West is the West, and the twain will never meet. It will be like God is God and human is human, and I can never become him. In order for us to be awestruck, Swami showed his divinity. In order for us to feel oneness with him and try to emulate him, he showed that human aspect, that human side, where it looked like anybody can do what he's doing. I think this is one interesting comparison that comes to mind when we see the Leelas and Mahimas of Krishna vis-a-vis the Leelas and Mahimas of our Swami.
Very true. In fact, even when we were studying about Swami's early childhood, one of the things is, most of these miracles which Swami performed, you were talking about the Kalpavriksham, where Swami would go and pluck different fruits from that same tamarind tree, or Swami would draw out objects from an empty bag, and he would give pencils and rubbers and sweets which the children would ask. None of this actually the elders saw. It was only the children who witnessed all of these things, just pretty much like how it happens in Krishna Avatar. I mean, all of these phenomenal things that we narrated were only witnessed by the Gopalas who were with Krishna. It was not witnessed by the elders. Hardly none of them actually got to see it. And even in the case of Swami would tell the children that if you go around telling this to anybody, I'll stop doing it. Mm-hmm. So it was only till much later all of this came out, and they would say that, yeah, we witnessed it. In fact, one of the people whom one of our boys spoke to, who happened to be Swami's classmate long back, he would say that Swami would take them to the temple and Swami would give aarti with his empty hand. You know, he would put out his hand and there would be a flame in his hand. Wow. Or Swami would fold his fist and he would hold it out, and there would be flames in each one of Swami's nails or something like that. You know, I mean, even the description was so mind-boggling, we're not able to comprehend how it would have looked. But Swami would do all of this, but only for the witnessing of these children who were around. It was not for the elders. So I think that's something we need to contemplate on completely.
But we need to be childlike, I think, to witness the Leelas, to witness right. such miracles. Without that childlike nature, even if a miracle is done, I don't think we'll be able to identify it.
Right. And just going back to that episode of Kubja, there's one thought which always comes when I recollect this incident. You know, here is a lady who is ugly, who is visibly a hunchback. You know, she's having this appearance which is repulsive. But only Krishna looks at her and says, Sundari. And he has, I mean, not only does he see the beauty within, not only does he express that in the form of words, but he alone has the ability to even convert her into that. Right? I mean, that's the, from the beginning to the end, all the abilities are with Krishna. When you look at it, when we came to Swami, you know, when we look at ourselves as, you know, humans with flaws, we look at ourselves as sinners, and we do this. We have our limitations, we're not able to do. But it was only Swami who looked at us and always addressed us as Prema Swarupalaras. And only he has the ability, I don't think anybody else we come across with life who
we'll
move with us,
embodiment right, of love.
Who live with us in our family, will look at us and say, Prema Swarupalara, you're an embodiment of love. I think only Swami has the ability to look beyond all our flaws and see that love aspect in us. And I think only Swami has the ability to transform us into that. And I think that is why we need to really, in whatever we do, as Swami was saying, let him enter our lives and let him disrupt everything, so that everything we realign to make him the focus and center of our lives.
on that note, dear listeners, we will bring our this satsang to a close. The next fortnight, of course, we'll be taking up general themes, but in the fortnight after that, we will again go through the different redemptions and annihilation that Krishna did. Once he came, of course, there is Chanura and Mushtika, then there is Kamsa, and there are many more. We'll cover that, and we will be proceeding with the Bhagavata Vahini during the next fortnight, after the coming fortnight. So till then, as always, you can write to us at listener@radiosai.org with your thoughts, your feelings, your feedback, whatever. We'll be grateful for the same. We offer this segment at the lotus feet of our beloved Sai Krishna, our beloved Swami, grateful to him as always, and we will end with this song, on the other side of which you'll be greeted by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love.